Echo, thanks for coming on, mate. Really excited to have this conversation today. But before we get started and we go through your career, just tell me a little bit about life right now. I know that I'm very grateful that you've come on the podcast just a few weeks out from your last fight. Just tell me a bit about life at the minute and what it looks like.
Life at the minute, what it looks like. Well, after a fight, usually there's just the whole come down and commotion of the fight. Then you have to get over the fight itself. And then you're just breaking into normal life. It's like you've been through that whole experience of devoting everything to your sport, your art. And after the competition, it's back to the real world. You're like, oh yeah, I forgot about all this. Mm. So like, it's just back to spending time with my loved ones and family and going through what every family goes through. Like my wife owns a business and just... doing my part, helping here and there where I can in that, and getting to spend time with the kids, really.
Do you get more, being an athlete, and because I was never an athlete, I'm going to be a dad soon, but I was never an athlete.
Congrats.
Thanks, man. I was never an athlete and a dad. Because the athlete lifestyle, you know, the hours that you work are kind of, they're different, aren't they? Oh. Do you get more time with your kids than you would if you were doing a normal 9-to-5 or...?
Yes, you do get to spend more time with your kids than you would during a 9-to-5. I think, depending on what kind of an athlete you are, the quality of the time might be affected.
Right.
Like, say, if I'm just in training, ticking over, then the time I get to spend with my kids is just, I can just have fun with them, mess around, not need to worry about resting or the next... training session I have, or because like I've had time to recover and whatnot. But when I'm in camp, maintaining my weight or losing weight, and I'm irritable and stressed from the things that I have to go through from the day to days of the athletic life, then it's a bit different. It's not like I'm stressed to take it out on my kids, no, but I'm stressed, I'm not having as much of a good time with them, or
you can't switch off.
Can't switch off. Or I'm too tired to be able to be my normal lively self and just run around with them. I'll let them run around and I'll just be plodding along after them, like kind of just trying to keep going.
And we were talking about a little bit before we got onto the podcast. What other thing? It sounds like you're quite a smart athlete in that you've got other things outside of boxing. So, is that good? Because when you finish a fight and you have that big come down, and you open the house door, you walk into your bedroom, and it's like, oh, it's all quiet now.
Yeah,
is that good for keeping you quite grounded and also switching your mindset to, right, I've got this to work on as well and this to work on?
Yeah, definitely is good. I think as an athlete, no matter what sport you're in, as high as you get, you have to think of it as like a springboard. And the more successful you are as an athlete, the bigger the springboard to what you move on to afterwards. And it's a smart thing to kind of start thinking about that and thinking about setting up the foundation for that, because everyone knows building foundations take a long time. But if you do it right, then it'll set you up for big things. One of the things that I do is I've got a business partner who used to be a behavior mentorist in an academy that I used to go in and teach the kids where to box.
Right.
And we formed a good friendship. He's one of my really good friends. Comes to all of my matches. Maybe bar one, and he's always feeling bad for missing that one match that he couldn't come to, but he couldn't. Like, it's just one of those things. And we started our business, which is it's called KO Interventions, in which we made interventions in the form of 8-week... programs for kids who were on the brink of getting kicked out of school or had behavioral issues. And during those 8 weeks, we would use a combination of boxing and mentoring and teaching them like 7 key pillars to improving their behavior, including just getting them to be accountable for what they do.
Right.
And we had a little study done on what we were doing at Bullwell, and we managed to turn around 80% of the kids that we were working with.
Wow.
So moving on from that, we've just started working in different academies now and just trying to get out there, really. Our website's more or less fully done, so okay. we won't have to sell ourselves as much schools. We can just tell the schools, visit our website and like hear all about us. And and instead of us knocking on their doors, I think we're going to have a lot of schools knocking on us.
Because
I think one move that would be really smart that I heard from like a business development agent that I talked to would be to get a white paper done or a journal written from a local university on what we do and the effects of what we do. And that would be a really good buy-in for the schools.
Okay. And how tough is that, mate? Because I work in schools as well. And the difficulty I always find is getting schools to commit to put some funding towards something within sport, which you would think schools would be jumping to do, but it's very hard, isn't it?
Yeah.
How hard is it to get to the right person in the school that can make the decision to sign it off and say yes?
You know when people say in life it's not about what you know, it's about who you know. It's always the case. It's always as you said, finding the right person with enough influence. They might not even be the person who signs off, but they have influence enough to get you that meeting or give you that chance. And a lot of the schools that we've worked in, we've had to either start off with a free package so they can get a taste of what we do, because when we tell them about what we do, they always say, oh, it sounds good, but how much is it? even when they ask for the price, they just say, it sounds good, but we need a bit of assurance as to how good this actually is. So we always have to end up giving them a taster. And then, but it works in our favour. Mm-hmm. I mean, give them a taster. The kids are really bought into it, then they don't really have a choice.
But that makes a lot of sense. Once the kids are excited, then.
The funding, I feel like a lot of schools are being privatised at the moment, or academies, or groups at the moment. And sometimes the money they set aside for some of those things isn't quite enough. So I think it's about, for us as a company, it's also about trying to get maybe government funding to help towards it. And that's mainly not even for the company just to profit. It's more so of having the capital and the money to invest in the people that are delivering what we have to offer. Because we even have, like, we have care interventions, knockout interventions, knocking out the barriers to success. That's what it's all about.
Brilliant, man. Yeah, it's
But it started off with a boxing intervention, but now we also have a social media intervention run by one of our influencers, and she does hers based on the influences of social media on young girls and young boys in schools, and just teaching them the pros and cons, in and outs of social media, and when not to take it to heart, when not to take it for gospel and stuff like that. And I think it's definitely something that, since lockdown happened, is definitely needed, because a lot of this generation growing up now have taken to social media and taken to just the media, the apps and the hype of things so much. So they need a bit of guidance. And I think this is one of the ways that we could probably help them. Because in our interventions, we normally find that the kids who are labelled problem children normally just need help turning their energy around and putting it into the right things. They just need a bit of guidance, that's all.
Mate, that's amazing. That's really interesting what you're doing with the social media as well, because that's something that I've done podcast episodes on. I'm very concerned at the moment, particularly with young women and social media. I think within young men, there's been a bit more of an outcry of, and more awareness around, the men's mental health problem in the last 3-4 years. Yeah. But I think the next wave is going to be young women. So it's brilliant that you're doing something like that, really positive. And turning your boxing into something super positive as well while you're still fighting, because a lot of people look to do that at the end. But you're right, now you have that influence and that springboard. You've got to really use it. Well, so
there's so many other things I can get into after boxing, but to have something that's running that I know will work, that I don't have to, not that I don't want to get my hand straight into it and work on it straight away, but to have something running, self-sufficient, that I can influence and whatnot, it'll help me just know that I have something stable. after boxing, and then I can really enjoy again, like trying my hand at all these different things, be it trying to be a sports personality or going on these different shows that athletes go on after their careers and stuff like that. Yeah, it's just like, well, you have to sort out all your chickens at home before.
But it makes sense that you're seeking out that security, because boxing just isn't that, is it?
Yeah,
elite level sport really isn't secure at all. Let's take it back, mate, to the start. Am I right in thinking that you moved to the UK at a young age?
Yeah. Yeah.
How old were you when you
moved? I was 11 when I moved to the UK.
You was 11 when you moved. And when you look back now as an older man at that time, how do you think that impacted you as a kid? Because when you're a kid, you just don't know any different. But now when you look back, what was that like as a culture shock, just coming to a brand new country? Oh,
I say to one of my best friends, or my best friend, James Wells, I say most of my life has been spent like adapting, because I'm Ghanaian blooded.
Okay.
And I say that because I was born in a country called Botswana, just north of South Africa, sharing the border. But in Botswana, you can be born there and not be from there.
Right.
So I was born there, but because my my granddad wasn't from there, I could not take I couldn't be classed as being from there. I could take residency or leave to remain.
Oh,
so
wow.
I could have a passport that basically said leave to remain. I'm allowed to be there, but I'm not necessarily allowed to work, so to speak. I went to nursery there, primary school. I think I was getting into the first year of secondary school. And then my dad was doing his PhD at Nottingham University, or he got into doing a PhD at Nottingham University, and he thought it would be a good idea for me to come with him because the education would be a lot better here in the West, and it's a lot more accredited and whatnot. So came over with my dad, but before coming to the UK, it was the culture shock of growing up in a Ghanaian household in Botswana, where the cultures are slightly different.
Right.
It's a beautiful place, beautiful people, and beautiful cultures, but still different to Ghana. And so when I was in nursery and primary school, it was kind of getting used to that culture. Mm. And then you kind of get used to it, feel at home, and then, you're going to the UK now. So we came over to the UK, 11 years old. And first thing that hit me, that was a shock, was the cold. I used to think, like, in Botswana, like, winter is maybe 15, 16 degrees.
Right.
And back then, we would be in big puffer coats, like, oh, it's cold, it's so cold. And like thinking, oh, yeah, this is proper winter. Summers are obviously great, because most of the time, summers are, like, above 35 degrees there, because it's semi-desert.
Right.
So coming to the UK, the cold hit me really bad. Like, feeling like 0 degrees for the first time. And the snow, well, I love snow, I just hate it when it's slushy, when it's melting away. The the culture shock of the UK, it's a good one. It was a nice one. Different culture, love the people, and it took some getting used to, because obviously getting used to the Botswana culture, learning English kind of with an American twang as well.
Right, okay.
When that came over, everyone was like, are you from America? I was like, no. it's been good. I did have a culture shock, a bit of clash of cultures, and sometimes it still shows itself in the way, maybe the way I talk or perceive things, or talk in metaphors.
Right, okay.
Or like, obviously, like in Ghana and in Botswana, there's a lot of...
like proverbs?
Yeah, proverbs and old ladies' tales and stuff like that. And they're worded a bit differently. So sometimes I'll say something that sounds similar to an English one, meaning the same thing, but I just say it in the most... People are thinking, why did you say it like that? But I know exactly what I mean.
Oh, brilliant. And then how did you find your way into fighting? Like, when did that first come about?
When I lived in Botswana, I was a big child.
Right, okay.
I used to weigh at probably 8 years old. Between eight and 11, I used to weigh more than I did when I was probably 16.
Really?
Yeah, I was, wow. I was like a unit. I was, yeah, a proper little unit. And in Botswana, before we came, I'd gotten into, like what got rid of a huge chunk of the weight was I got into swimming.
Okay.
Ended up swimming for my swimming team out in my secondary school in Botswana. Really cool. I don't think I'd be much of a swimmer here, but I was a good swimmer there then. After that, I got into playing rugby as well.
Okay.
Then came over to the UK. Before I came over to the UK, I did karate as well.
Right.
But then I think we was practicing for a competition and a kid did a spinning back foot heel kick, landed on my temple.
Right.
I didn't pass out or anything, but at that moment, I was just like, this is not for me. I was like, kick to the head? No, this ain't for me. No, I've had enough of this. So I didn't end up competing in karate, but I just learned it.
Right.
So I was a little unit with hands. Right. And then came over to the UK. I'd lost a big chunk of my weight. I was still big-ish, got into football and then basketball.
Right.
And I really enjoyed basketball. I got to a level where I was playing on like a Midlands team, and then I was being linked with an England team as well. And I wanted to play for Jesse Boots, at the Wildcats Arena in Slenton. And because they're like one of the best team in Nottingham, one of the best teams like in the UK at the time, if not now. I'm not too sure. I don't follow it as much now.
Yeah.
But they were the team to be on,
right.
And I wanted to be on the team to be on. So I went for tryouts there, and they basically told me I'm not ambidextrous enough and I'm not fit enough. So come back next time. So I was like, in my head, I had to sit down. I was like, okay, I'll show you. I'm going to take a year out of all the normal basketball that I'm doing, work on my game, like dribbling on both hands, get fitter. And when it got to the point of getting fitter, one of my mates, Craig Montgomery, at the time, I remember his name, he used to be in the army, and he used to do a bit of boxing at a club near me, and he told me, nothing's going to get you fitter than boxing. And so I went to Bilbra Boxing Club, ran by Ray Ricketts, my original boxing coach. And yeah, from there I was just built from scratch with my two left feet, my clobber in hands, and yeah.
Amazing, mate. And when you look back now, what natural gifts do you think you walked into a boxing gym with? So, you know, it's funny, like, I heard someone say recently that do swimmers look like swimmers because they swim? Or do they look like swimmers because they're attracted to swimming because they look like they're that shape? Does that make sense? What kind of things did you walk into a boxing gym with, do you think, that were like real natural gifts that helped you within boxing?
When I was younger, I didn't really used to think much of boxing. I remember my dad and I used to wake up and watch Mike Tyson matches. And aside from that, there was just no interest whatsoever. I just thought, yeah, it's two guys hitting each other. First one to hit wins, basically. Mm. I couldn't have been more wrong. I've always been quite a cerebral person and tenacious and tunnel-visioned.
Okay.
So boxing, being what it is, where you need to really dedicate yourself to it and put in a hell of a lot of energy, and with it being like quite cerebral in the concept of it being physical chess, I really took to it.
Right.
Yeah. And I had asthma growing up as a kid.
Okay.
And you'd think that would that would not help with boxing, but one thing I found growing up was if you warmed up properly, I used to think if I warm up properly then I'm not going to have an asthma attack, because that's like the basis of, if you warm up great and properly, you won't have an asthma attack, even if you have asthma. And so long as I warmed up properly, I used to go hell for leather thinking, well, what's the worst that can happen? Yeah. I'm not going to have an asthma attack, so I'm fine. Like, everything else is just a plus. And that's probably what developed the concept that people now call the engine, because they have a good engine. But I get tired like everyone else. I just getting tired doesn't bother me. Mm. Yeah.
What role did boxing play in your teenage years, Eka?
Boxing's been around for so long. For me, I started boxing in 2008. Actually, no, 2006. And I think that was just before I started college. And obviously, growing up before that, yeah, it was in year 11, I remember, because I remember a few schoolyard maybe disputes where I used some boxing knowledge, not right. punching people, but more the defense.
Right.
Just like bobbing and weaving out the way of punches and people would be like, oh, damn. So that was good. But boxing's influence on my teenage years, it definitely gave me a good sense of self and self-confidence.
Okay.
Contrary to what people think, boxing actually calms you down, as opposed to, like, people think, oh, you teach a, say, naughty kid or just a fiery kid how to box, you're just going to fight everyone all the time. But it's actually, it does the opposite. It kind of teaches you, like, your hands are weapons, use them wisely, kind of thing. It makes you stop feeling the need to prove yourself. Mm. Like, why do I need to prove that I'm this or that? I know I can do this. I do this every day, kind of thing. What's the point of proving it out and about with people? And so I'd say boxing's effect on me in my teenage years was just gave me reassurance that what I put my mind to, I can do. Right. It calmed me down, but it gave me self-confidence as well.
So do you think that the big advantages were more kind of like the mental side of things?
Yeah, definitely the mental side of things and the physical, because, I mean, the fitter you are, the clearer you think. Mm. So definitely help physically, the physical confidence, just knowing your body, knowing how it can move, knowing what it can do, being more bodily aware. And then the mental benefits of just knowing how to get into a routine, how to stick to a routine, how to be accountable for yourself, and just the confidence that comes with that.
It's really interesting what you say as well. It's almost like a paradox, right? That everyone thinks, well, if you take kids to boxing, they're going to get more aggressive. It's quite. When I was younger, I used to get into quite a lot of fights when I'd go into town, but I've never thrown a punch in my life because I was petrified of hurting my hands for gymnastics. But I think it's that I've got quite a cheeky face. People just like to hit me.
Yeah.
But I think I'm more dangerous because I hate confrontation, so I get very nervous around confrontation.
Yeah.
But the fact that I don't know what I'm capable of, I think someone like me is way more dangerous in an atmosphere where things are kicking off than someone that actually knows how to fight. They'll be a lot calmer because it's almost like an insecurity within me, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that makes a lot of sense when you say that.
Yeah.
You know your temperament. I when I watched your last fight online, it was interesting listening to the commentators saying that, you know, Eka just needs to stay nice and calm. He's very good when he's calm. And they're kind of saying that you've got very good, like, temperament, so you keep nice and calm under pressure. Is that something that you have naturally within you, do you think? Or was it something that you consciously developed, like you worked on?
Oh, yeah, definitely something I consciously developed.
Right, okay.
Growing up, I was quite a fiery person, but then I cottoned on to the fact I'm quite a I can be quite a fiery person, so always kind of put that slight limiter on myself, and boxing definitely helped with that, because in boxing, when emotion comes out and you're not calm, you don't box as well.
Right.
Like, you're not as level-headed, you don't make decisions as good as you can. So it also taught me through that, well, actually, if you stay calm under pressure, you can think clearly, you can do things a bit better and whatnot.
And that, when you made your debut, your professional debut, Eka, that's at 27, am I right? 27 years old. So tell me about that space between that. You know, you're a teenager, year 11, you start boxing, and then you don't make your pro debut till 27. What happens in that gap? can you fill that gap in for us?
Oh, life happened. Going to college, got some A-levels from college. Then I ended up, I did like IT, ICT, business studies and media studies at college.
Okay.
Just things. I thought, I love media. I'm a bit of a nerd. I love computers.
Right.
And I could probably do with some business acumen. Chucked them all together.
Yeah.
And then at university, I did marketing, design and comms because I thought that was a culmination of what I did in college. And I come from a family of academics.
Right.
Like my brother was at university doing microbiology, then he ended up doing pharmacy. Now he works in a private pharma. My dad has always been in education. He did his PhD in education. My mum used to own her own textiles business in Botswana, like a fashion business. Then came over to the UK. She's a teacher now, but she also did a degree in international fashion.
Right.
Yeah. So
very successful. Like a
So like academic family, and I was the I'm gonna just do boxing.
Yeah.
But my parents were like, no, you need to get your degree, your degrees, or you need to have that educational background first and foremost. So at least, like moving past that, you have something to fall back on, kind of thing, which is very logical and smart thing to do.
For your parents to say, yeah.
Yeah. Went to university. That's where I met Mr. Wells, James Wells, who's now my corporate manager.
Okay.
During that time, I had started boxing, obviously, at Bilbra Boxing Club, run by Ray Ricketts. Like some people start off and they just naturally have it.
Yeah.
I didn't naturally have it. I had a good right hand, but I didn't naturally have everything else in boxing. So I just had a good growth mindset.
Open to learning.
Yeah, open to learning. The more time, the hard work pays results. The harder you work and the longer you work at it, you can only get better from it. And that's what happened, really. My debut, I beat someone who was at the end of his amateur career and wanted to go turn to professional boxing. He'd only had 11 amateurs, which isn't that much, but he wanted to become a professional. I beat him on my debut, and it really was a shock to the system. It really showed me how hard boxing was.
Right.
But at the same point, it was like the moment when everything clicked, like, I kind of really enjoy this, as hard as it is. It's a good challenge to have. And from there, we moved on to just boxing my way through until my first loss. That was another time when I appreciated boxing more, because I think when I first started, I had my good win against that guy turning a pro, and then I started getting some knockouts, and I started thinking, I'm the man.
I'm the guy.
I'm the man. Like, I'm him. But then I came up to fighting someone who actually handed me my first loss as an amateur, and it made me think, damn, there's like so much more to this than I thought. Like, I need to improve my game so that doesn't happen again. And that's just that's what happens when you have a loss. It's find the changes you need to make, apply them, and move on, really. After that, started improving more. I started beating people on the England setup. And then people kept shouting out saying I should get a chance to do the GB trials.
Right.
But at the time, I don't think people liked my style for that kind of boxing. I've always had more of a pro style than an amateur style. Regardless of that, I kept on beating people I shouldn't have been beating. And then I finally beat someone who was a well-renowned GB boxer.
Right.
And it was only after that and competing in the national championships and getting to the final that I was finally kind of given a nod and given the Team GB trials. And that was whilst after college and whilst I was in university. Just before that, there were some ABAs, Amateur Boxing Association National Finals, that were coming up. And I specifically remember this because I'd finished uni, actually. I was working in... I was working as a web developer, junior web developer for a company. And I'd been given this opportunity to go on Team GB. Not Team GB, sorry, I've confused myself there. I'd been given this opportunity to box in the national finals and possibly get a Team GB trial.
Right.
And the place that I was working at the time, I thought, actually, maybe I just need to dedicate myself to boxing. So I took a bit of time away from that and just dedicated myself to boxing without the whole setup of GB. I'd be like training in the morning, having a little break, training in the afternoon, have a little break, training in the evening, sleep. And did that for maybe two months and then felt like, yeah, I'm ready. Went to these championships and got to the final. Didn't quite win them, but that's what definitely helped me get my Team GB trial.
Right.
And that trial was basically started off as me and I think it was 40 other boxers at the time. And you go there every week, Monday to Thursday, go through what you have to go through, like waking up early in the morning for the weigh-in, the runs in the morning, the S&C in the late morning, and then sparring in the evenings. And then that number always dwindled down every week. Like someone would be slacking on the runs, they're not there the next week. Someone's slacking on the S&C, they're not there the next week. Someone's slacking in the sparring, which was the main part, and then they're not there. And finally, it was down to me and another lad who was a wicked boxer, but unfortunately for him, I was more successful. So I got the nod to be on Team GB. And it was wicked, wicked experience. And at the time I was, working in a company in web development and as well as being on Team GB. And through the successes of being on Team GB, it took me away from work a bit more and more, to the point where it probably got to the point where my manager at work was thinking, like, because we didn't have the work from home scheme then.
Right,
if we had I'd be fine. I could do all this web work whilst being away on a tournament and in my rest time. Yeah. But unfortunately, we didn't have that then. So I think it just got to the point where I needed to leave that job. And I did. And that's when I went into boxing just full time.
That was it.
You don't get handed a Team GB contract every day. It's not something you turn down. It's a once in a lifetime kind of opportunity. So I grabbed it with both hands.
How many years were you on Team GB?
I was on Team GB 2012 to 2016.
So for 4 years, a whole cycle.
Yeah, a whole cycle.
Do you know that, just to go back to that process, mate, where you started with 40 boxers and you were the last one, how long was that process? And do they still do that now? Is that how
I'm not sure if they still do it now.
Because that sounds so cool. Like that should be a TV show.
I remember feeling like it was Contender. If you ever watched Contender, I felt like that. I was just like, yeah, I'm going to come back next week. I don't care about everyone else.
Yeah, what a great way. Like, that's like old school football trials, you know what I mean? Like,
it worked out, I think it was between 4 and 6 months altogether.
Wow, really? So a long time. Yeah. Wow, amazing. So that's probably like a real baptism of fire as well. Like, then knowing what, at that point, if you survive all of that, then you're probably going to be able to handle being on the Team GB squad and doing all
that. But even, like, I knew people that were surviving that at the weights below, like the trials. Sometimes they didn't make it when they was on the team.
Right.
Like, there's just so many turning cogs that just have to align.
I've spoken to a few friends that have been on like the Team GB team with like boxing. They do say there's a lot of politics that goes into it.
Yeah,
there's a lot of that, especially when it comes down to like Olympic selection.
I left after when I found out I wasn't going to be able to have the chance to go to a qualifier.
That's when
I thought, I'm done as an amateur. I'm not staying on for another cycle.
And is that the point you decided, let's go pro now, it's time to go professional?
Well, originally I wanted to go professional in 2012. But my amateur coach, Ray Ricketts, had said to me, and my now pro coach at the time who was helping at the club, Barrington Brown, they had both said to me, nah, give these ABAs one last go. And then when the Team GB trial came up, they said, nah, give it a go, because not everyone gets to get on Team GB. So I would have turned pro earlier, but I decided not to obviously pursue the greatest amateur accolades.
when you look back now, Echo, do you think actually in hindsight that decision not to go pro at that age was actually a positive one? Because, you know, your first 19 fights, you go unbeaten professional fights. Do you think it was a real advantage that you turned pro a bit later than, say, somebody would have done if they hadn't gone down the path you had? Because you sound, from chatting to you today, you've got a very mature head on your shoulders.
Yeah.
You know, very smart, like you said, quite cerebral. You're thinking about things. You're already planning your future. Not a lot of athletes are like that. Yeah. A lot of athletes are kind of all eggs in one basket. So do you think actually making your pro debut at 27, having had that experience on Team GB, having to earn that experience through that process, actually was a massive advantage?
Yeah, because... say my counterparts or my peers or my competition, a lot of them would have started at that time, a lot of them would have started boxing at the age 12 or 11 when you can first start, and they wouldn't have been through as much life as I had.
Right.
They wouldn't have been through the girl stage and the I can go out now stage and getting over that, and I'd been over that, so I could dedicate myself a bit better, a bit more than they could, because they just hadn't lived life to that degree. So obviously they'd want to live life to that degree, because a lot of boxers start off wicked when they're in their teens, then they go through that stage, fall off, and then they come back, but they're not quite the same. Sometimes they come back better, but they're still not quite. If they'll probably always have that, if I stayed with it, could I have been better?
Right,
kind of thing.
Yeah.
But that's just, it's a life thing. But yeah, I think for me starting boxing later than others, it was a good thing. Yeah. I was in the right headspace for it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And just being able to take more of the emotion out of decisions we're maybe making and dodge some of the potential, like, banana skins that were coming up, you could avoid them a bit more because you had that more life experience. That makes so much sense. I mean, I was one of those kids that was just a full-on from a very early age, but was just not a very well-rounded person.
Yeah.
And I was amazing in this one area, but I had no social skills and I'd missed out on a lot of that, so that makes a lot of sense. When you first won your... I think you won the European belt first, is that right?
I won the English title first. Yeah.
So you English title, then you win the European.
The European,
and
then
is it British and Commonwealth?
British and Commonwealth.
What's it like, you know, like, you going on that process, being a bit of a... starting pro a little bit later, making your debut later, you're on the Team GB setup, but you never get that chance to go to an Olympics or whatever. What is it like then, having all of those belts and almost being like, wow, it's worked?
Yeah, it's real. It made, you know, like when athletes or people have imposter syndrome.
Mm.
Like for me as an amateur, I hadn't won the ABA elites, which normally you win that, then you get in Team England or Team GB trial. But I'd never won an ABA. I'd had two ABA finals that I'd got to that I just struck out. But then I go on and I win the English title. And then I'd won a few gold medals and silver medals, but then certain tournaments I also struck out on them. But then I went and won the European title.
Mm.
And then I went and won the British title and Commonwealth. It just hit home with me, just like something that I'll say to people, if you know your worth, got to hold on to it.
Mm.
You got to believe in it. You got to nurture it, and then you got to become your worth outside of yourself. Like, you got to show your worth to other people, and that's in that long process of years. That's what I did,
yeah.
And when I realized that, it just reminded me, like, know your worth and keep it.
And it's not easy, is it? Like, you know, people will now see you in big fights on the TV and stuff. That's not how it starts, is it? That's not the reality. Like, you know, you talked about having a job first and then being on Team GB, and then you got to the point where you were probably getting funding, right?
Yeah.
So you could then step back and focus more on the... But then as soon as you go pro again, you're back to...
not a lot of people know. Like, I only came to having such a prolific profile when I got signed to Frank Warren for the second time, because I'd signed to him after my second pro fight.
Okay.
But we had to part ways because unfortunately I wasn't getting enough opportunity at the time. Right. And I understand why, because I was a pro, an old pro. I'd had two matches. I wasn't really proven. Mm. Everyone said, oh yeah, he'll be a good lad, but there wasn't much to back that up and prove it. So I wasn't getting as much opportunity as I wanted. And my manager and my coach and myself just had to go through the long process because we didn't have that GB funding backup or the Eddie Hearn setup from the go, or the Frank Warren setup, proper setup from the go. We went about just hustling and making our own opportunities, like making fights for myself, getting the money up for those fights. Some fights I'd walk away from them screwing, or I'd go into fights screwing, knowing I'm paying my opponent this amount of money and I'm coming out of this fight with like 400 quid, 600 quid, and he's making good money, like a couple of grand, a couple of like quadruple grands and whatnot. And I'm thinking, oh, like I've got to make this hustle work for myself. And obviously I did, coming through all of those fights unbeaten and winning the English title, knowing I wasn't getting paid probably as much as I should have got paid. But obviously it's a means to an end. Mm-hmm. Like you've got to put the work in. One thing I've said to people is, I might have been on the GB setup, but I've gone through the proper small hall boxing shows and everything, just like everyone else, because I think it's something that will help build you as a person, build your boxing character and build your experience up as well. And it's only when, after I'd won the English title, that I finally got made mandatory to fight for the British, that I got... That's the side that everyone got to see. They just got to see
the tip of the iceberg.
Everyone just got to see Echo's fighting for the British. Oh, he's on Frank Warren now. They didn't see the whole the animal that got there before there. The not the nice, calm, well spoken Echo that speaks on Frank Warren, that is a bit more mature, that knows the influence I have on people, and so I conduct myself a certain way. They got to see the mature version of me, or the matured through fighting version of me, not the hungry happy beast. The angry happy beast.
And sometimes you've got to do that. You've got to force things into action, otherwise the world isn't going to do it for you.
No, the world isn't going to do it for you. So you just got to get your big boy pants on, do what big boys do.
Man. So then you do that, you get those belts, and then you end up fighting at Wembley. You quite rightly put me in my place when we went for a conversation, and I was like, you know what it's like when you compete in front of 20,000 people, and you're like 80, and I was like, wow, okay, I got no idea what it must be like competing in front of 80, just for people back home, because that is, you know, I think that period of time was almost like a special window in British boxing as well. Like, there's not many of those Wembley fights happening right now, right?
No.
So it was just the right time, a sweet spot, and what is it like walking out in front of 80,000 people? Do you almost... Is that so many people that it doesn't even feel real, really?
Yeah.
And you then comes back to just being you in the boxing ring.
It's very... It was an overwhelming experience. But I say that because I wasn't even supposed to be on that show. I got a call. Like, I'd been supposed to fight on a show maybe a week or two afterwards at your call, but I was supposed to headline that show, so I was so amped for that show. But then I had a call. I had a dream. The Sunday before that Wembley fight, I just had a dream, like, that I was fighting at Wembley.
Really?
Like, I was like, And then I wake up thinking, oh, it'd be so waste to be able to fight there. But I'm not, because I'm fighting in 2 weeks at your call. That's cool. Like, I have my own, I'm headlining my own show. I cannot moan. Like, I'm happy, yeah, kind of thing. Content. And then I was running around, like, we do this warm-up lap on the Forest. And on that Monday morning, I was running on the warm-up lap. And that dream popped up in my head again. And I was just like, it doesn't matter, because I've got my own headline show. Like, them Wembley fights will come when they come, kind of thing. Come back from the warm-up run, and my manager's pulled me aside, like, ah, oh, I had a phone call. And I was just like, I just looked at him, I said, tell them yes.
Didn't even ask.
He was just, and then he was like, tell them yes, you don't know what for. And I was like, is it anything to do with Wembley? And he was like, well, the question they asked me was, they know it's 2 weeks before you have to be on weight for your fight. Can you make weight? And then that night I went away. Obviously, I made weight by force. Well, not even by force, but I was going to make weight and I made weight. Yeah. And that's a way of proving to yourself, yeah, I can make weight without having to be unhealthy and make weight, like, drastically. And so, obviously, we've shot back to everyone that needed to be told, yeah, I could make weight. And then the next day, they said, oh, we could possibly get you on this Wembley show, now that we know that. Then the day after that, they just sent us details out. Can you be at the Wembley show for the press conference and this, that, the other? But unfortunately, because of the way they sent the information, we got to the press conference an hour late. So we missed our press conference, but we were still there.
Yeah.
And then obviously I did the weigh-in and everything. And everything never really got the chance to sink in. Like, everyone around me kept asking, are you excited to be fighting in front of so many people and this, that, the other? And I just said, I don't have time to think about that. I'm just focused on the boxing. Like, I just need to focus on the boxing, because at the end of the day, when you're in there, you're not looking at the crowd. You're focusing on your opponent. I kept telling myself that until it came to the night of the fight. About to walk out. Yeah, but you can hear it sounds loud and everything. And I'd been on little walks on the backstage bit, the open air bit, where you could look into the crowd, and it wasn't quite full. So, like, it didn't seem like I didn't think it was going to be a thing. Little did I know, when my music started playing, and my head started buffing, got my hood up, starting to do the ring walk with my team, and then, like, as we kept walking, I do this thing where I start to slowly take my hood up, but when I flick my hood back and I looked up, I was just like, oh damn, there are so many people here. That's when I heard everything. You could hear the roar of the crowd, you could hear everyone screaming, it was just, the air felt electric. going into the ring, I was just like blown away. Like, yeah. And my head only got into that match maybe around 3 or 4.
How hard is it in that situation to be like, I've got to actually fight?
You're
looking around like
around 3 or 4.
How hard is it to just, right, tell yourself, right, and everything I've learned quickly, just, do you know what I mean? When I had Lee Wood on recently, he was talking about this, and one of the gymnasts I had on, they were like, you do the work, so in those situations you can press the autopilot button.
It was kind of cruise through, and then it hits a moment where you're just like, oh no, I need to do this, I need to do that, like, I need to do it, and you're just in the room, in the work, kind of thing.
You know when you're fighting Echo, like, are you hearing everything outside here, or is it, are you in a zone? And you, because when I used to compete, obviously very different, but when I'd be up there could be a lot of people there.
Yeah.
But when I was performing, it was almost like I couldn't really hear them.
I was
in it.
Yeah.
What's it like for you when it's that scale? Is it just impossible to do that and you're just hearing noise? Or are you still able, even in front of 80,000 people, to bring it down to just you and one other guy at the other side of the ring?
Yeah, I was able to do that. Initially, not. The whole buzz of it took a little getting used to, but as soon as Well, just like I'd said to people, well, when you get punched in the face, it's seen your attention soon goes to where it should go to. So it did. But yeah, in boxing, even though it might be loud, you do learn how to hone and zone into what you need to. Like, I'll hear my coach's voice and my corner's voices, but I'll be able to block out a lot of other people's, the whole sound of the crowd and whatnot.
What about, so can you tell me a little bit about the difference between the mindset of defending titles as opposed to challenging for them? And how is that a different pressure?
Yeah, different pressures. Like I've been through since...
Because you did four times you defended those belts,
I think five times. Yeah. It's a different kind of a mindset. Attaining is always feels like more of a rush. Like when you're going for like they say, the person at the top of the hill doesn't work as hard as the person going up the hill or isn't as hungry. Not that you're not as hungry, but the person going up the hill, you're super hungry, you're grafting, you're going through it. Every little step up that hill, you're just like, yes, I'm getting closer, I'm doing it. When you're at the top of the hill, you're kind of at the pinnacle, you're fighting people coming off, but it's not quite the same as going up, not the same rush. That's similar, or you can see that as a parallel to defending and going four belts. But defending is still, it's still a position where your tenacity, your fire comes out, because you're just like, you're not coming to the top of this hill. I'm at the top of this hill. You're not knocking me down this hill. Do you know how long it took me to get up this hill, kind of thing? It does have its pressures, like always defending has its pressures. One of my favourite fights in the last few years was, because I've been defending the British for British, and I had been defending the British and the Commonwealth for a while. It was January of this year. I defended the British and Commonwealth titles to a boxer who had the WBC silver title.
Right.
And during negotiations, we got him to put his title on the line.
Right.
And at that moment, things just switched for me. I was just like, ha, gotcha. That's my new belt. Like, everything changed from, oh, I'm keeping this guy away from my belt, to I wasn't even thinking about keeping him away from my belt. I was just thinking, I'm taking his belt. Like, it's just like that switch. Like, it went from, I'm kicking people off the hill, to, oh, there's another hill right next to me and I can get that belt. I'm going to get that belt, kind of thing. Like, yeah, so...
How easy is it, Echo Light, to fall into the trap of, if you're defending, almost then kind of being on the back foot and thinking more about what your opponent's doing, rather than if you're chasing, it's all positive, like you just said, like,
yeah.
Oh, now there's something for me to take. Now I'm just going forwards.
Yeah.
Do you have to... You know, is that something you're conscious of if you are a boxer? That you have to be prepared. Right, I need to make sure I'm not putting too much emphasis on what they can do and still focused on what I can do.
It's about give and take. Give and take. You have to learn a sweet balance between obviously going to attack, to attaining the points, to land the punches, to knowing that defending isn't actually a bad thing. Let them come after you, because they can walk onto a shot. So if you give and take right, you can attack and lull them into a false sense of them coming forward and attacking you and make them pay for it. And yeah, it's a, when you hit that sweet spot, it's a nice place to be.
Yeah. Tell me what was the approach for the latest fight? You know, when you sit down before you start a training camp, do you sit down and go, right, this is our overarching tactic for this camp and this fight? Do you have those conversations with your coaching team, so there is like a clear plan, right, for this fight this is the approach?
Because my opponent was well known for spoiling his work, we knew it was going to be a very physical match. So going into the match, we was ready to make it a real physical match. However, in the match, I don't think the ref adjudicated the match as well as he could have done.
Right, okay.
Certain things were just let... my opponent was just off the reins in terms of the way he fought, kind of in a dirty way.
Right, okay.
That weren't, that he wasn't called up on as much as he should have done. And when I was ready to fight fire with fire, I was reprimanded for it.
Right,
so okay. It was kind of just like, oh, well, I can't fight fire with fire, so I just have to focus on the boxing element of it. And when it got to that, I wasn't able to box as well because of the way he fought, which is like testament to him. That's just the way he fights. So it's good in the respect. However, I think if the match was adjudicated better by the ref, I think it would have made for a cleaner match, and I would have been able to box better, and would have been a better match altogether. But I mean, the takeaways from that is just like, I don't need to learn lessons twice. Like,
yeah,
you give, just give what you get. Like some people say, you drive the car till the wheels drop off. Just give what you get till the wheels drop off, regardless of what's been said to you, adjudicated and whatnot. And just, it's definitely brought back that tenacious, vicious mindset.
Okay, right.
In which you're thinking, I wasn't given the chance to box right. And then I'm thinking in the back of my head, I shouldn't have been thinking, oh, I just want to box right. I should have been thinking, oh, I want to hurt him. I want to get him out of there every single round, every single instance.
Yeah.
So it's just about going back to remembering
what got you to the race in the first place.
You don't get paid for overtime. You just have to be more cutthroat. If you don't smell blood, if you don't smell blood, you've got to make blood, then you've got to take them out.
Yeah. Just tell me a little bit, mate, about what is the structure of a training camp like? How's it like broken down, like in terms of the weeks? So like, how early do you start preparing? And what does a typical training day look like when you're in camp and you are going through those days where you're knackered and shattered?
Yeah.
What does that look like just for people that you just wouldn't know, you know?
Some boxers tend to like have a 10 or 12 week training camp. But outside of that, say they won't be training. They'll just be just living life, doing whatever they want to do.
Okay.
Holiday, but then they might gain weight, just be out of it. So that's why you need a 12 week training camp, because you're thinking they have to lose all the weight and fat that they've put on. They have to get back into the basics of training, and then probably by week 4 or 5 in the camp, that's when they're actually just boxing like they normally would, but not at the weight, and then they spend the rest of the time getting fitter and making the weight. But the way I train all year round, like I just stay in the gym, stay active, keep my weight between a certain percentage. So my training camps aren't as long. They're shorter than the 12-week camp. Because my weight's at a good place, I get to spend more time focusing on the technique as opposed to getting the weight down. And that makes a big difference.
So you maintain that like base level fitness just all the time? So you're ready to go whenever?
Yeah, within striking distance. Yeah. Kind of just like one of the things I learned when I was on Team GB, like if you stay with your base, have a good base level, stay within striking distance, when those tournament calls come up, you're just like, yeah, I'm ready.
A mistake someone might make if they make their debut very early and don't have that experience with Team GB and you've got a younger head on your shoulders?
Yeah,
you might go, oh, this is great, I made it now, I'm going to take a break, go on holiday, and then that's the type of things where maturity can like be a real advantage.
No, well, a lot of the time, their coaches would probably rein them in, tell them that they couldn't have as long as a break or whatever. But yeah, with Barrington Brown, I remember in my amateurs, he used to have this rule where I could fight on the weekend and I'm back in the gym on Monday morning. Just even if I'm not training hard, even if I'm just doing shadow boxing work, but I'm just back in the gym. So I know, like, yeah, you win. That doesn't mean that the work stops. That just means you still got to think about your improvement. Even if you win, you got to think of where you need to improve, where you went wrong, this, that, the other. Like, yeah.
Discipline.
Yeah, keep it grounded.
Yeah. It humbles you as well.
Yeah.
I remember a coach telling me once that even if you win a gold medal, you're a champion for the 2 minutes that you're on that podium. Yeah. As soon as you walk off, and there's a target on your back.
Yeah.
It's a good analogy, isn't it? It's like, you think you're the best, but it's literally 2 minutes. As soon, now, everybody's trying to be the world champion the next year in my sport.
Everyone's
it's like every year.
Coming for the jugular, they're coming for your throat.
Just about the build-up to the last fight, mate. So just what was that week of the fight? Because I imagine that's very stressful anyway, just for someone to go a week build-up, because you've got to do the press conference, everyone's asking you the same questions. Sometimes you've got the other person you're fighting giving you a load of jip. That week, what was your mindset that week? Do you know what I mean? Is there anything you look at back now, you're on the other side of the fight, and you go, that was maybe a little bit different to what I normally do, I felt a bit different? Or was there none of that? It was business as usual?
That week it was just business as usual. You know, the way fight weeks happen, that is just the case. You just have to learn how to navigate around it. You have so many media commitments, be it photo shoots with your match kit to the press conference, and then obviously at the press conference, everyone wants to see a fiery press conference. So that's really up to you and your opponent, really.
Do you ever have a pre-conversation? But does that ever happen? It's not. So there's never like a, oh, by the way, should we just like amp this up a bit? That is genuine.
If you're genuinely cool with each other or friends,
right,
you could say that.
Mm.
If you're friends, you know, look, you're going to box, but it is what it is. Oh, should we just like mess about?
Mm.
Like, yeah, that might happen. Or I've heard of that happening. But
right, okay.
In general, no, you don't really talk to your opponent too much. You either cordial with them, like, oh, you're right, mate, yeah, this and that, and or he's just not
bothered.
Not bothered. My opponent was very loud and brash and wanted to have a good back and forth.
Did you play ball with that or not?
To some degree. It's not really playing ball, it's just saying what I needed to say, really. It's all right to just ignore people, but it's not all right when it's just disrespectful kind of thing. So, I just said what needed to be said, really.
Yeah. And what is it like, mate, when my sport was a bit like yours in that it was up to a judge's interpretation. Same thing for you. You've got judges scoring a fight, right? And you've got a referee to contend with. How difficult is that, that you know that, well, I can still do everything right, but it can be... the decision's in somebody else's hands. It's not like, you know, when you do a 100-meter final at the Olympic Games, fastest time wins. It's obvious, right?
Yeah.
But in our sports, it's not always the case. How tough is that to deal with afterwards when you've had a loss, but also just in general building up to a fight? And there's always the chance, you know, when it goes to a decision that it might not go your way.
Well, just like I said earlier, it's just... even with that in the back of my head, and it sucks when you think, oh, I did everything that I did right, but it's still not gone my way. Or like me saying, what would have happened if the ref adjudicated it better, and why was this allowed, and how could he be scored in his favour when he was doing all this and that? In all honesty, when you think about it can't be changed now.
Yeah.
So none of that matters. What matters is moving forward, I work on the controllables, what I can control, and I don't worry about the uncontrollables because you can't control them. And the uncontrollables are the other judges that can, if it goes to decision, it can go in any favour. Mm. You can't control that. You just have to go in the controllables, which is, for me, the mindset of, well, maybe I just have to make sure it's not in their hands. So like I said, you just have to have that blood first in boxing, where it's like every round is a round where they need to touch the canvas or you need to get them out of there. That way it's a 10-8 round every round. It's just a 3MB, 3-minute beating, a malicious fight. And yeah, you just have to go back to that mindset, really.
What do you do now, mate, when you've had a loss like that? What's the approach in terms of you and your team? Do you all sit down and go, right, let's analyse that fight, let's look at where it went wrong, what are we going to do moving forward, like, what does that mean now for our next fight, when's that going to be, what does that look like for people? Because people just wouldn't know, would they? If you're not in the world of boxing, you wouldn't understand, like, that once you've turned the TV off and you've you know, you paid for your pay-per-view, then you have to deal with the consequences of that. What does that look like for you now?
I've already had an initial sit down with my coach, just match review the where we could have gone better, gone through the typical like match review and places to improve, what we can actually do to make those improvements and stuff like that. Mindset changes and this and that.
I imagine the temptation as well after a loss is to go, right, let's change something. But actually, that didn't get you to where you got to. How important is it that you stick strong to and just pivot in the right directions?
Yeah.
Because you must see that a lot in boxing, right? A lot of people change camp, change coach.
It doesn't always have to be drastic. It's when look inward and really find what led to where you need improvements. And if you can come to an agreement, you and your team, of where you can improve and whatnot, then you just need to do the action of doing the improvements instead of, oh, I need a whole new team. Yeah. Like, it doesn't necessarily always work like that. Sometimes it does. But that's up to the person. Like, if they feel they need a new environment, new team, new this, new that, then obviously everyone has their own truths. Yeah. That's true to them.
And what we're getting to the end of the year, mate. We're going to enter into a new year. What are your hopes for next year, the future, inside of the ring and also outside of it as well?
Outside of it, I'm going to be building my business and making new connections and just enjoying life outside of boxing more so. Like, I put emphasis on that. And in the ring, I know it was unfortunate in my last match, the result, but I know I'll get more opportunities from it. Mm-hmm. I'll still be ranked top 10, if not top 15 in the world, in the IBF. And with that comes matches and opportunities. So I'm in a good place regardless. And as they say, all the greats took a loss.
Oh, 100%, mate.
Yeah, I don't think as a great in any sport, you can actually say you've been through and come through adversity, but it just shines through more after you've had something to come back from.
And also, mate, like, I think you learn way more about people when they've suffered a loss or are going for a challenge. Like, anybody can be happy and positive when things are going well.
Yeah.
I'm more interested in what you're going to do when shit hits the fan.
Yeah.
Like, how do you react? How do you stand up then? And from meeting you today, it sounds like you're a very level-headed, super smart guy. But also, I imagine that your best achievements are yet to come still.
Yeah.
That work that you've done, my favourite part of this conversation today was honestly hearing about the work that you do going into schools.
Yeah.
I think it's an amazing thing, because when I go into schools as well, when I do that work, I always see it as, this is just a net positive. There's no bad that comes from this. Like, I'm going in, I'm inspiring kids, they're getting to do more PE and they need more of that.
Yeah.
I'm a good role model and I get paid to do it and the schools get a lot out of it. There's nothing like this is like a real net positive thing. Yeah, it's great.
You're giving back.
And you're using like your career and story to give back. If there are some young kids that are listening to this podcast, whatever sport they're in, they might not even be in sport, and they are finding it difficult at school and they're struggling, they get into trouble a lot. What's the kind of advice that you would give somebody in that position?
That kind of advice I'd give to someone in that position is there's always opportunity to get what you want out of life. It's just about, as I said, knowing your worth and working on it to keep it and prove it to everyone else. It doesn't have to be done in a negative way. You just need to find ways to channel your energy or channel what you want to do. Find out how you want to do it and how it's possible to do it, then you just need to work on it. You can work hard on it and work smart on it. Don't just choose either of them. Should do both, because you can work hard at something, but if you're not working smartly, you're not going to get much progress. And if you're working smart on something, but you're not working hard at it, it's not going to get much traction either. But if you work smart and you work hard at it, more than likely you're going to get a lot closer to where you want to be.
Have you got any tips, Echo, for anybody that's struggling with self-confidence, whether they're a young kid or an adult that struggles with that? Have you got any tips, anything that you found in life that's helped you like build your that self-worth that you talk about?
Yeah. Your word is your bond.
Okay.
So if you say you're going to do something, especially to yourself, those promises you make to yourself, you have to keep, because once you know that you keep your promises, your confidence will just come so much higher. And once other people know that your word is your bond, what you say you'll do, they'll respect you so much more as well.
That's amazing, mate. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, man. Yeah. I really appreciate it. Great conversation.